Burn.
Steve!
It's
what's
snowing.
Happening?
I heard it's still snowing.
Oh, so, man, we had an ice storm over the weekend. It's still wrapping
come
up.
Come on.
Terrible.
Terrible.
Power outages all over the place. Yeah, widespread power outages. Not me, thankfully. But ice clinging, like an inch plus of ice, and then it sleeted, and then we got about 6 inches of snow over it. So
tomorrow's April.
And then we got another snowstorm Wednesday. So, yeah. If you want to reach Elmer, he's been without power for some time. I believe he's at the Holiday Inn in Eagle River, room 316. So you can just dial him up and cheer him up, folks. Cheer him up. He's bumming.
Imagine. Finally, you know, for me, it's finally coming around. We're dealing with all kinds of spawn fun. You know, it's just never ending.
You were saying the other day. That's right.
It's goofy. It's mixed bag. Everybody keeps messaging me, you know, whether we're all over the South, obviously the South and Pennsylvania, everywhere. It's mixed bag, guys. It is total and utter sheer musky chaos on what are they doing this spring thus far. You know, you just have so many powerful storms. I mean, we just got rocked today with some pretty heavy stuff. So it's crazy. Just keep an eye on your water temperature. So if you think they're spawning, they probably are, if it's acting that way, because it's been... You know, I mean, Jay, I've seen everything this week from mid-40s to low-60s, you know, and you're like, what?
Okay.
Yeah, it's just mixed, depending on runoff and everything. But anyway, the comings and the goings, we got stuff, I couldn't believe it, finally drummed up. Jay got them going here, got some of the Lee Lures back in stock here. What do you got? Boilermaker 68.
Yeah.
Got the 69.
Yeah, he's got two new Boilermakers, 68 60, so they're like a stagger blade. Uh-huh. Boilermakers. One's got a mini body, the smaller of the two numbered one, and uh-huh. the larger one is a mid-sized body. Uh-huh. So yeah, it's been a while since we had some Boilermakers. Those look great. The quality, of course, but his stuff is excellent.
Yep.
And we got a couple sizes of his Ninja Bucktail. You might have heard about that
Ninja.
One too. So incredible bulging kind of effect on that
incredible
thing.
Bulge.
It really pushes.
What an incredible bulge.
Yeah. So, well, heck yeah.
Heck yeah. Jay, it's a bulge to admire.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you've got frickin', like, if nothing else, you could weaponize them. So got the Ninjas. That's a good alternative. What was the fixed blade company there for a while, Jay? A lot of people...
The Bite Back Trilogies.
Yeah, there you go. So kind of, I don't, you know, can't. Those are hard to get your hands on right now. So if that's something
we've got them.
For.
Yeah, we got
them. Oh, do you have the Bite Back back in?
Yeah.
That's a minute.
Yeah.
So
in the couple
same,
sizes.
Yeah, in the same vein there. Definitely something different there. Something
right.
different.
Right. Right. You don't have to trip. You know, they're both in the same vein that you don't have to trip the blade. I mean, it just starts rotating and it's not a blade. It's a
Ninja.
Fixed wing aircraft, I guess is what you could say.
Ninja.
And we got a nice little special starting tomorrow morning around
9 o'clock.
Maps.
Jay has
Maps.
I feel like I was at Sunday morning church. Jay has a special, everybody.
Yeah, we do have a special.
Did you ever
yeah.
do that when you're growing up? Somebody get up and sing. Hey, we got a special.
No.
Okay, maybe it's a Southern thing. Go right ahead.
MEPS number 5 Aglias. There's a bunch of them. We carry, you know, the MEPS number 5, the MEPS tandem number 5, and in hair, in flashable, in single, and in double blade.
There you go.
So there's, between those combinations, there's probably 200 choices, and they'll be 15% off starting tomorrow.
MEPS coming in light with only 200 choices.
Yeah,
right. Whoa, come on, step it up, MEPS. Really? We demand far more. If you can't find what you want in 200 choices, that's
yeah,
funny.
And that's those are springtime catch anything, including
yeah.
muskies kind of presentation. Everybody knows that, so
yeah,
that's a good one and great timing on it. Yeah, check them out. They'll be on the website tomorrow mid morning.
Very cool. I mean, those are fish, like you said. Just if you're looking for that multi-species madness, you found
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Two, only 200 goers available, folks. Get in, log it, set your alarms. There's only 200 colors available. We're probably six deep on 200 colors. Anyway, fantastic. I keep saying it every week, but I promise you the planer boards will be here. It's like a broken record, but I don't control the shipping company. But if right. I did, they'd be here already, but they will be here shortly.
It might even be this week.
Yeah. So you'll get your notifications. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I'll tell you, freaking, I played with it the other day. I actually called my buddy. It was like, you never freaking 9 miles an hour. You're just not going to believe them. Just when you get your hands on, I was seeing, we're taking it to the extreme, you know, uh-huh. I think when we did the video, on the original proto little hand built deals, we're doing six. And I was like, ah, screw it. What's the worst that could happen here? Nine. Like, you're never, it's ridiculous.
Nine's like water skiing.
Yeah, I mean, it was in the, like, of course the blade was like planer board's behind the boat because it's just laid back, but it's rowing in the roller. It's like, oh, come on. Freaking 10-inch headlock back there. It's like, this is a joke. So, those will be here shortly. Jay, first and foremost, I got to say, I'm off. My phone blows up all day long. You know, hard to answer. And out of nowhere, pops up. It says, somebody I hadn't talked to in a while, it says, Spence Petros. And I had no clue. And I ran back here as quick as I can to the studio here in the Bait Cave. And I said, we better record this, right? So, guys, if you don't know who Spence Petros is, just got to talk to him, obviously. He is literally the legend's legend. And what I mean by that is the people that you go, these are legends of muskie fishing, literally go, Spence is my legend. Like Herbie, Joe, anybody and everybody. He's the guy that did the stuff. You know, we talk about it for a second. You'll hear a lot of stuff he's saying where you'll go, well, Steve says that. Through osmosis, through just sheer, like, you can't say it any other way because Spence said it first, which is amazing. You know, going back and just a precursor to this, because we were just, I was shooting from the hip, trying to get as much out of him as I could. Mentioned somebody I've mentioned a bunch on the podcast before, he is the godfather of structure fishing, which is Buck Perry, which I think we still have spoon plugs, Jay.
We do. Yeah.
Hard to get because these are old school, old school, but just for reference, so you don't have to go Googling here. You know, Buck Perry invented what is considered, he invented structure fishing, and here's Spence Petros working with him hand in hand. And so anything and everything, these guys invented the terminologies we use. Like, so when you hear him say, like, they were like, oh, what do we call this? We should call it a break line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. Right. Like, this is like Prometheus of everything. This is the center of the atom, the nuclei of structure fishing, multi-species of anything, you know? So a lot of these guys, when you see your Roland Martins, your Jimmy Houstons, all the guys that were on TV back in the day, they were going to these guys. These are the guys that taught a lot of these guys what they were doing, you know, as far as this is structure fishing, this is what's happening. Obviously they didn't show them everything they know, but there's like Don Dixon, Buck Perry, Spence Petros, really ingrained into just the terminology of this stuff. He mentions when I talked to him, a guy I didn't even realize that named weeds, you know, so what do we call this weed? Let's name it this, you know?
Cool.
So it's really cool. So I'll roll that, guys, soak it in. Live it up. The legend of legends, Spence Petros. All right, guys. I've got the man, the myth, the writing, the angling legend himself, the grandfather of all, Spence Petros. How you doing, Spence?
Pretty good, actually.
Yeah. Good deal. Good deal. Guys, you know, try to lead you in, I'm sure, on the bit, first half of this. But, Spence, tell everybody kind of the about your career. Some of the things you've done here, you know, you've earned a lot of titles. You've been in the Freshwater Hall of Fame for eons. Kind of let the listeners know kind of about your career and what you've done.
Okay, well, I started with the magazine and Fishing Facts in August of 1973. And my first day was at the big trade show where I met a lot of the heroes that I had been reading for years, you know, so I was a little bit, wow, this is really cool. And then with the magazine, I got into the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in 1989. With the magazine, you know, we're right on the cutting edge of all the breakthrough structure fishing stuff, mm-hmm. you know, where it was structure fishing. It wasn't just a pier or a stick in the water. It's not structure. It's the Buck Perry, the teaching, which really started everybody. Mm-hmm, the early absolutely. Pros like Roland Martin and Dance and all those guys, they're all privy to the Buck Perry stuff too. I mean, that's why one of the reasons they got a big head start on everybody. And I had structure fishing classes for 41 years in the Chicago area. I was probably did 125 to 150 TV shows. We had our own show on ESPN for 4 years, the Outdoor Writers Nationwide. They did a lot of shows with Winkleman and Roland Martin, Linders, and some other people.
Yeah.
And let's see. I was a partner in the manufacturer's repping business for 11 years, where we had Lindy and Johnson's, Deep Woods Off, and Lamaglass, and Big Buck Tree Stands, and a bunch of other stuff. And since probably the last 15 years, I've been guiding. Now that I retired, it's just like, something to do. Just basically gets me out of the house two or three days a week. I have an excuse.
Absolutely.
Like, well, I got a guide today, you know, so.
You got to have an excuse. Yeah. Well, you hit the operative thing. I didn't know you would go there, so I'm going to pick your brain on this. You know, my last book, and I've written tons of articles about it, and I've referenced Buck Perry a million times. Structure fishing, my whole career kind of is based on a lot of your early work, and a lot of that work is systemic off of Buck. You knew Buck, correct? Or
I fished fished with him several times, and I was actually an honorary casket bearer, pallbearer, at his funeral a few years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a piece of work.
Well,
we were going to a restaurant, you know, having breakfast, and he'd take out a napkin. He'd start writing stuff down, and here's why this point could have big bass, and this point would never. And he showed the way it would break in relation to the river channel and the depths. And he was writing down stuff that even to this day, I have still not heard, you know, any of the many, many copycats that mm-hmm. stole the stuff. Say about it. So he was quite a character. He was a real Southern gentleman. I think he was a colonel or something. He had a pretty good military ranking, and he was something else. He was a genius and a very interesting person. So he was quite a character.
Like you said, influenced. There wouldn't be a lot of the names you know, definitely in the heyday, 70s and 80s, without kind of what he had done. Well, you said you did structure fishing classes for so many years, so you ought to have it memorized by now. Why don't you lay it on us a little bit? What back in the day, you're doing a structure fishing class. There's no internet here. What's kind of the points? Where did you start? Lay it on the listeners here. Lay it on me, because I'd love to hear kind of what the teachings were there and where you guys were going with it.
Well, I had several different classes. The one class was bass and panfish, and the other class was pike muskies and walleyes. I think that's the way it was. And then I had two classes. Each one ran for 6 nights, from, let's say 7:30 to 9:30. Mm-hmm. And then I had an advanced class. After the two, I would get half the people from the advanced classes, from the regular classes, that would come into the advanced class. There, I would do more specific things like catching big falls, smallmouth on Lindy rigs and suckers, mm-hmm. or something like trolling a jerk bait, when and how to do it. You know, that would be the advanced class, a little more offbeat stuff. But the early classes, you know, the regular bass class, we just take it right from, when the water starts warming, here's what you start looking for. And then here's the presentations that work there. And here's the presentations that work there. And one of my regular fishing partners, Tony Portencaso, he was the guy that started all this weed stuff, mm-hmm. for writing articles on weeds, October of 1973, where he had the coontail and the cabbage and the sandgrass. And he gave all these weeds names that to this day people are still using and have no idea, you know, where it came from. That's so phenomenal. Then, you know, we did a lot of stuff on the weed fishing and, you know, fishing the weed edges. And what do you look for? You know, the changes, the difference in the tapers, the different weed types and the different kind of bottoms they grow on, which is the first ones to come up, which might be tobacco cabbage, which are also the first ones to die, you know, in mid-fall. But which weeds will stay the longest? Which ones will do this? And then the ways to fish them. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just weed stuff. I mean, it was for bass. And then, we talk about night fishing and walleyes at night after dark. And where are you fishing the weeds and what you start using? And mm-hmm. then night muskies. We talk about muskies, you know, day and night, where a lot of that muskie fishing was revolutionized for night fishing for muskies back in the day. You know, guys like Joe Bucher was certainly one mm-hmm. of the leaders on that kind of stuff. And Joe and I did a muskie get together in Wisconsin. It was, I don't know, 500 or 600 people muskie weekend, and I was talking. Joe had done it a bunch of times, and during the day I think there was 3 muskies or 4 muskies caught all weekend. Mm-hmm. And then we went out Friday or Saturday night and caught 7 and one, you know, one was over 30 pounds because it was a night bite,
right?
And it's the kind of stuff you get on a lot of these clear lakes. A clear lake with a lot of boat traffic, you know, it's almost a waste of time to yeah. fish more than earlier and late in the day.
Right.
It's like this, you know, that kind of stuff. So there were just so many breakthroughs. You know, we had the suspended muskies and, you know, just so many different things that we did. Now you got the guys running around with four forward-facing sonars. They can go from 20 to 30,000 acres a day just looking for fish and don't cast until they see something, you know. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's a different world. Different world. Ten bucks. You and Booker were on North Twin, right?
Yes, actually, we were that night.
I knew you were. I guarantee it.
Did Joe tell you that one time?
No, I wasn't even born yet, but I knew better. You're sitting here just based on time of year. Anyway, with the structure fishing, gonna lead you by the nose. Give us. You're 1 degree removed from Buck Perry. So what's the rules here? What are the basics of structure fishing? Can you kind of walk me through it? Walk the listeners here through just at least the starting point of what we're looking for.
First you have to understand what structure is. And structure is not weeds, a boulder, a pier. That's all cover. And structure is actually the bottom conditions. It could be just a drop-off where it goes from 15 to 20 feet. That's structure. That's the edge. That's a drop-off. Structure could also be one of the biggest bass I ever caught was, you know, a little over 10 pounds. It was in Florida. The structure in there was actually more of a break line. Break line is changes. It could be from hard bottom to soft bottom. In a situation in Florida, I was casting along the shore with a guide. And he says, here's where we catch him. I start throwing a crankbait out to our deep water, and I get a couple of bass. And I said, you know what? I'm going to troll. So I start trolling the 15 to 17 foot hard bottom, soft bottom edge. First bass I caught was 10 and a quarter. Then I caught a 7 and an 8. You know, and it was down there. It was like, something really weird because they wouldn't even think of stuff like that. Yeah. But there's so many times I've went to places and applied Buck Perry's structure stuff. I've gone to the Amazon and you go and you see, well, let's see, this river bends like this. Well, if it bends like that, the structure on the outside bend, it's got to be a sharper drop off. Now, there's a big tree right there. Now, of this block or two area, that big tree right there with that cover on the outside bend, which would be deeper water, that taught me a little bit about the structure and the cover. And go there and, you know, catch a 20-pound peacock bass. I've gone to the Arctic Circle, you know, the same kind of thing. So many places that I've gone, it's that whole understanding of everything, mm-hmm. The edges, it's what the fish follow, the movements of fish. When Buck came up to the Chain Lakes in northern Illinois, people were fishing the weed lines, and the lake was pretty clear. Mm-hmm. As the lake got dirtier, the weed lines receded, and the bass fishermen followed the weeds in, and fishing got worse and worse. But the bass were on the structure. They were on the edges. They were on those points. They'd come up on the points and feed. Sometimes the movements were real good. They'd come up back up into the weeds. Mm-hmm. So when Buck went up there in 1957 with outdoor writer Tom McNally, who was the big guy in Chicago and in the country, he was really, really was one of the major guys. And his son Bob is a good friend of mine, also a great, great writer. But he went out with Tom McNeely and Bucky. We'd been there for 2 weeks, patterning these fish and trolling, catch them off a point, then he'd go and anchor and then throw out, you know, with jump lures, mm-hmm. or deep diving spoon plugging and work them up the structure because, you know, the bass were starting to come. And he had it all patterned. So we went out with McNeely, and they went out for 3 hours or 2 hours. He told them, Tom, do whatever you want, Tom. So Tom fly fished one in the shallows, caught one bass about 3 pounds, and Buck was actually shocked. Mm-hmm. And then they went back, you know, right where he had patterned these fish, and bam, 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 they had a stringer. And it was either 10 bass, 5 fish limit, or might even have been 10 bass, 20 fish limit, but they were all 3.5 to 6 pounds. Whoa. And, you know, and it was like, Professor's Perry shows how it's done, this kind of thing.
Right.
With this magic lure, the spoon plug. And what happened, Klein's Sporting Goods in 1957, they had ordered them, and they had made a big promotion that we have the spoon plugs open up on Monday. That Monday, there was lines there. And in this line, I don't know if it was in the same line, but I was in the line, the Linders were in the line, Tony Fortin Casel was in the line, a bunch of the guys were there buying them. Mm-hmm. And people bought them. I went to Lake Geneva. I stood on the piers. I started throwing them out. I'm not catching nothing. You know, it's now this is a farce. It wasn't. It was just I didn't know how to use them. You know, yeah. It wasn't a magic lure. It was the whole system of troll. He had the 200s, the 200s, I think 300s, 400s, 500s,
yep.
700. But they ran like 2 to 5, 5 to 8, 8 to 12, 12 to 15, they ran at different levels. Mm-hmm. And the line that he uses was a no-stretch line, and he was buying nylon that they use for hairbrushes from DuPont, rolls Whoa. Of nylon, and making the no-bow line and color-coding it every 30 feet. So if you know if you got 30 feet, 60 feet, 90 feet out, that you can control it. The lures he had, they could go 1 mile an hour or 8 miles an hour, and they always stayed at the same depth. You know, he formed them, bend them, and spoon mm-hmm. plugs and that kind of thing. And the other good thing, it would pick up a weed or something, it would come right to the surface. Or all of a sudden, you could rip that short, stiff little rod, mm-hmm. blow the weed off, and rip it, go right back down to where you were. So he had this really, really good system at a time there was no depth finders.
Yeah.
You know, he'd go there and be able to map a lake out. He was on the drop-offs, following the structure, you know, putting it all together. And you know, we saw as the weather was overcast and stuff like that, you know, how the fish would tend to come up. Sometimes in a dark lake, they wouldn't even come up till the sun came out with dark water. So, you know, it was this whole concept, finding these edges, these places where the fish will go along and, you know, come up on them. And now they're finding more and more of the suspended fish with the electronics out in the middle of nowhere and,
right.
and that kind of stuff. So, you know, and they're catching them like that too. But, you know, the old stuff still works. I mean, I'm still doing it, and I guide. And I don't think I had any one trip under 30 bass last mm-hmm. year on Delvin Geneva. So the old stuff works, too.
Absolutely. And, it's amazing. I mean, you're talking about, you know, for me, that is people, you know, have been doing the show forever in writing, and it's just like always referencing back to, you know, structure's the end all be all. You know, it's the ultimate thing, and understanding that, you know, and I've tipped my hat to Buck's work for forever, because it's just amazing. How, let me ask you this, because with you being so close to, you know, that group of anglers, and how on earth when was the epiphanous moment for him? What was the moment where this clicked? Did you ever get that story out of him?
Yeah, actually, he'd be fishing with his dad. They'd be fishing in the spring and casting toward shore. This is in Buck's words. They're casting toward shore. All of a sudden, the weather gets hot, and they're casting. He goes, Daddy, those fish aren't there. They're behind us now in that deep water.
Uh-huh.
And that's, according to him, I don't know what his age was. He was pretty young. And that's what he told his daddy. Them fish are out there, Daddy. They're out there in that deep water. And then he started devising a plan to do that. And his whole thing was a stiff rod, the no stretch line. And then I fished with Len Hartman,
yep.
who was also a big pioneer. They found out that he was putting sand in some of those 45-pound muskies and making them heavier. But nevertheless, the guy was. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, at that time, you know, you want a war bond and $200 worth of lures from Field and Stream. It wasn't right, like right. it is now.
Yeah.
And the Lawtons were doing it, and the Hartmans were doing it, two husband and wife teams out of St. Lawrence. But I fished with Len. We brought him out of retirement. He was living in a mobile home in Florida.
Uh-huh.
Brought him up there, and I fished him with the St. Lawrence. He did the opposite. He was using a long, you know, 8-foot rod or whatever it was that was sort of soft, and he was using a stretchy line. And when he trolled, that big square lip lure that he had that would go down pretty deep, the lens, musky bugs, or whatever they were called, that rod tip would bend a certain way. You just go boom, 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 and would hit bottom. That cadence would change a little bit. You would just, you know, sort of catch. So he could tell how deep he was going. Also, he could tell the speed indicator by the bend on that rod. So he was doing a lot of the same stuff Buck was fishing. He was fishing the edges of the river channels, the deep stuff around the dams, but he was doing with the opposite, a soft rod, a line that stretched, a rod tip that bent for the trolling speed indicator. So, you know, he was sort of doing the same thing, except, you know, he just did pad a few pounds on here and there.
Just a little, but, what's a little sand between friends?
Yeah. Well, yeah, a little wet sand. Ah, what the heck?
Eh, whatever. He's a beach musk.
But again, you know, he was another innovator that, you know, did his thing. And the thing that was good, and I went out there with him. He had never had a depth finder. And we went out. And I said, okay, I'd say about 3-4 times, I'd say, Len, how deep is it right here? And he would say, should be 25, 26 feet. I'd look at the flasher that I had at the time, and he was always within a foot or two. Whatever he said,
he knew it. Yep.
So it's a shame that he had to end like that. Yeah. You know, going, you know, being great and coming back up, and going, then being retired and coming back up again. He goes, "Oh, you resurrected my life," because his wife died, and then all of a sudden, you know, basically found out that he was full of crap on some stuff. But he did was a good fisherman. He did catch a lot of big fish, but you know.
Yeah,
it is what it is.
Is what it is. I mean, they're pioneers of. Like right. Instead of that's structure fishing, something that I'm always talking about is, you know, how important it is to your proximity to the fish, right? And I always, anytime I'm kind of second guessing myself, I always look at spoon plugs, right? There's not a lot there. There's not a lot to that lure. A spoon plug is a, in my mind, a depth delivery system, right? It's just meant to hit a certain depth. Where to me, I think a lot of anglers spend too much time on fancy paint jobs opposed to let's get close to the fish. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, my favorite color is chewed up.
Chewed up, yeah, that's a good color.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, too much. I mean, I like. If it's sunny out, maybe I'll use something a little more natural, or you know, a little more natural, or something flashy. You know, if it's dark out, maybe it's something a little brighter or get thrown in there with a Lauren's chest on a perch pattern or something like that. And I don't even know if it makes that much difference. But, you know, sometimes it might, and, you know, sometimes it won't. So, yeah. What is it?
What do you think of, you know, you fish for every species everywhere, right?
Yes.
What's the most important element to what, like, is it a structure thing where, okay, we're interpreting structure and we're getting closer to the fish? Is it profile? What's the, like, you know, because there's always this hierarchy of what matters, right? What do you think is the most important factor of what matters to generate a strike? Obviously you got to be where the fish are, but is it proximity? Is it the right profile? Is it
like one thing that Buck says a lot of it is speed control. I mean, remember years ago, though, you had to crawl that bait across the bottom real slow because the water's hot. Well, that was a bunch of crap. And Buck always said there's sometimes you can't bring a lure in fast enough to trigger a strike. And that's the one thing that he said there was always like, I don't know about that. I could reel in pretty fast for a bass. And I was in Florida, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, and we were fishing a lake, and this lake had a big, pretty wide canal connecting one part of the lake to another. And I was trolling. I had spoon plugs on the edge of this canal. It broke about, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 feet, something like that. And it was weeds, and it broke into the river channel. And I was trolling. It was the middle of the day, and I'm going what I thought was pretty fast. And then the guys run shore. Come on, Spence. Come on, let's go in. Come on, time to have lunch. And I wasn't getting anything. And like I said, I was trolling pretty fast. So then I started going way faster and reeling my spoon plug in while I was going faster than I was going. And all of a sudden, bam, I caught a 6-pound bass. And I said, whoa, hold on. I kicked it up again. I kicked it way up high again, and I ended up catching, I don't know, 4 or 5 bass right in a row, right where I was trolling, because my speed control wasn't fast enough. And I've seen this on muskies, too. I mean, even in the fall, I'm trolling for muskies, and I'm still might go 4.5 miles an hour, and the water's 44 degrees. Yeah. You know, I tried different things. It might go 5 or 6 miles an hour or more in the summertime. But the speed control, you know, there's two ways to get a bite. Number one, you can tease them with live bait or slow moving or stop and go or something like that, or you can trigger. So you could tease or trigger. If you're teasing, you want the lighter line, the slower presentations. If you're triggering, you want a faster movement, you know, a little heavier line and something that every time and then bounces off something. Because if you bounce off something, you don't want to be constantly banging, but if you bounce off a high spot, number one, it lets you know you're down there. Number two, it's a good way to trigger a strike, like the tip of the point or something like that, you know. And it's just a combination of understanding what you're faced against and then trying different depth levels and then using depth and speed control, which he always stresses, the depth and speed control to trigger the strikes. Yeah. I mean, there's no basic solution, this and this and this. It isn't. And you know, you're good enough a fisherman yourself where you know it's a lot of things that you put together. The one thing is you just don't sit there and do the same thing all day. No. That's one thing I can tell you.
Yeah, Mick.
Because another thing the Buck says, the fish are the shallow, the deep, or somewhere in between. He'd do a seminar and says, I always know where the fish are. He goes, you are. Well, where are they? They're in the shallow, the deep, or somewhere in between.
I stole that one from him. That's for damn.
Yeah.
I say it all the time. It's just like, they ain't in the woods. They have not crawled out of the lake and gone into the woods. I mean, you know, because around my household, a lot of your guys' work was just pivotal. You know, I reading your stuff as a kid and obviously all Buck stuff and just, you know, taking that. And it's almost hard sometimes, you know, you try to have a conversation with somebody and when you talk to what I call a spot fisherman, right? Well, that's a good spot over there. There's fish there. It's there's like a, do you ever, you know what I'm talking about? Like there's a,
absolutely.
A knowledge gap, and it makes it difficult where, you know, I try to pound it here on the podcast or my writings or in the book where at a certain point you have to, like anglers have to have that breakthrough or they're always just going to have kind of lackluster results. What's your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, they have to have a bad result before they get good. I don't know. I get, it's been so long. I hate to sound like a jerk, but it's been so long where I didn't know what I was doing. I can't remember. You know, for 40, 50 years, I've always understood this kind of stuff. And I've always had good success. That's when I was, you know, 12, 14 years old. I was, pretty good fisherman then. I beat all my uncles and my dad and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I think a lot of it is just an insane desire. Mm-hmm. You know, even now, guys want to go in and, you know, 84 years old. No, well, let's stay another hour or two. Or the guides say, well, you're guiding for 7 hours. Yeah, well, how come it's 8.5? Because they're still biting. I don't want to go in. Well, it's okay, Spence. We can go in. You know,
right.
I still got that in me, you know, that kind of stuff. So, I don't know.
I know you can, you know, it's one of those things you can, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink kind of deal. So,
yeah, but I got some guys.
Right. But, you know, as far as structure fishing, let's say somebody's thinking this, what's the first kind of breakthrough? What's the first thing that somebody can kind of get to make it click in their mind? What's the first thing somebody ought to do? Is it sitting down with a map or what would you recommend for somebody that's thinking about taking on kind of the mantra of structure fishing to get started?
Well, the best thing to do is go out with somebody who knows what the hell they're doing, a guide or a real good friend on a good lake, and have them explain to you. See, when I'm guiding, that's what I'm doing all the time. I'm explaining, now here's why we're doing this, now we're doing this, now we're moving out a little bit deeper to the fringe weeds. Although on the weed edge here, we may be getting some bass, we're getting a lot, but if we get on the fringe weeds at 17, 18 foot, we got a better chance of getting a 3, 4, 5 pounder out there. So to go out with someone or join a fishing club where they have outings And it's hard just to go out there on your own. If somebody shows you and all of a sudden, oh yeah, that makes sense. And I would say go out with a good guide and have them explain things. Now, you're not just paying someone to sit in front of the boat and catch fish, mm-hmm. you know, and while you're watching. That's not a good guide. A good guide lets you catch more fish than him, or he tries to let you anyway. Sometimes you're a lost cause, but you know, you never know.
tell it like it is. Don't hold back. But
I've generally been called the shortest distance between two points.
Absolutely. So that's the best.
That's what you get from me.
Absolutely. It happens to the best of us. Yeah. Well, it's fascinating to think that you've been through every iteration of what modern fishing is at this point. What are your thoughts? And I know it's hot button, but you just volunteered. You're not known for bullshit. What are your thoughts on forward facing sonar?
Well, I don't know. I think you can't stop it. Mm-hmm. So if you allow one per boat, that would be one thing. And if you reduce limits, that would be another. You don't want to catch 25, 50 crappies, or, you know, catch 10, 15 crappies or bluegills or something. And, you know, just lower the limits a little bit and make it just white. You're not going to stop it. There's too many of them that are being sold now. Mm-hmm. You know, my own feeling is I don't even know how to work the damn thing. At 84 years old, how much more time do I have left? And plus, I still catch quite a few fish.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I asked you just from the standpoint of going, that you weren't dreaming of that in the 1970s, that would ever be a thing. You know,
No, not at all. When the paper grabs first came out, wow, this was great.
Right.
So you had rolls and rolls of paper everywhere, and it, you know, things just got better and better and better. And, you know, I got the basic stuff on my boat, but, you know, I still do all right.
No, absolutely. So, yeah. You know what you know? Well, and that's the thing, though. If you know what you're doing, and fishing has not changed. You know, the boats have changed, the rods have changed, the lures and this, that, but the act thereof, you know, to muskie fishing, because you still got out, you're up there. I know you're in Andy Myers this past summer swinging the axe, you know.
Yeah, we got some.
Oh, good.
Sorry. We got some pretty good ones. Nothing real big, 49 and 3/4 was the biggest, but we got some nice fish. But I was, stuck, but I was fished with, the camp owner. See, the camp owner's son, I took him out when he was 13, 14 mm-hmm. years old, and he got his big fish every year mm-hmm. and got him started muskie fishing. And all of a sudden, I hadn't been up there with the COVID for a while. So when I go up there to camp owner, Julian, he wanted me to go out with his son. He wanted me to show me how good he is. So the kid's winning all kinds of bass tournaments and stuff. Mm-hmm. He was 19 years old and a very good fisherman.
Absolutely.
But, you know, a lot of it, we'd go to spots and, oh, there's three muskies down there. All right, we'll cast right here. And my thing is, I really don't care that much for following fish. Even if I'm fishing Geneva, a lot of these guys mm-hmm. are throwing rubber in the deep water and they're getting follows. And I might be bass fishing, but all of a sudden I'll see a wind and cloud cover blown into this inside corner of this weed bed. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, you know what? These weeds are in 16, 17 feet of water. The wind's blowing in. It's overcast. I'm going to go in there and cast. Mm-hmm. Because if I go in there, and if there's a muskie, and there's a good chance I'm going to catch them. Okay. You know, I'm not interested in just wasting my time. So I'm fishing more for fishable fish.
Fishable fish.
Now, when I was up there in Eagle, there's times it was dead calm, and we're fishing clear water. Oh, there's two fish down there. Throw over there and do this, do that. And you know, I could see the forward facing. I could, but I can also know that spot that we just fished, I never caught a fish there unless there was a strong north wind, because the rock bar went out to the north and it mm-hmm. broke about 8 or 9 feet. It didn't break deep enough where they would come up there, you know, unless there was a strong wind. So I wouldn't even fish that spot until there was a strong wind blowing on there. And then a lot of times I caught a big muskie there. But yet we'd go and fish it down to 15, 20 feet. And, oh, yeah, there's four fish down there. Well, they're there, and they're still there, and they're not hitting. So the difference that I would have would be, are too many of these guys fishing for unfishable fish? Okay. I don't know.
That's interesting. Well, let me focus it on this then, right? Because, you know, I have forward facing. I've done the same thing. You go, well, they're there, but they're not. They won't eat. What? Take it back to old school, right? But how do you dial in on those better areas? How do we dial in on where we're going to find a muskie that should be actively feeding?
Well, the thing I do before I go out to the lake, and I like to fish lakes that are big and different kind of water color. I'll say, okay, which way is the wind blowing and what are the weather conditions today? Now, if I want the clear water, the deep clear water, a lot of times that's where the bigger fish are at. You get your, 53, 54, 55 inches there. Mm-hmm. So I might fish the first hour or two in the clear water. And as the sun comes up, based on the sun and the wind, am I going to stay there? If it's cloudy and windy, I might stay there. If not, then I'll go where areas of the water is a little more stained. I might have to go 10, 20 minutes, 30 minutes to a little more stained water. Now, if we get up until 1 or 2 in the afternoon and the sun comes out and it's sort of calm, well, I'm not going to go back to the clear water because I'm going to go down in that dirty, stained, garbagey water where I catch a lot of fish in basically 6 to 10 feet of water.
Right.
And a lot of times it doesn't really get good until it gets sunny down there. Mm-hmm. So I play wind and water color, which definitely tells me where I'm going to go when I get on the boat in the morning, if I have that option. And even on a good lake, a bigger lake like that, which way is the wind blowing? I'm not going to fish calm water. Even at night, nighttime muskies, oh, yeah, we're going to go get a topwater lure and go throw it in the shallows and blah, 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 blah. Well, my buddy Joe Booker proved this many, many years ago. We'd go get a jointed depth rater and go fish the windy sides of the lake. And at night that we caught down 7 or 8 on that big tournament you mentioned.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing. We'd go fish a jointed depth rater on the windy side of the lake. If you want to fish on the windy side of the lake during the day, then why wouldn't you want to fish there at night? If the fish are there, they're not going to move from there to the calm side of the lake. Mm-hmm. So, it's the same thing. The wind and velocity, direction, and conditions, overcast conditions, cloud clear, all that. That determines where I'm going to go. Then I'll start picking my spots based on that. And I try to fish wind. Mm-hmm. I almost always try to fish wind unless it's real strong. Right. Then I'll fish the eddy. Then I'll fish the eddies, where it curls around it or, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. The other thing I do, too, is I will troll. Like, there's certain spots. I don't know if you ever fished eagle.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, where it's that big reef over there where the world record was caught. Coleman's.
Yeah.
Coleman's Reef. Now, you can go and cast Coleman's Reef. It'll take you an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. And you can cast, it might be a 200, 300-yard stretch mm-hmm. all the way around Coleman's like that. And guys will do it a lot. I hardly ever fish Coleman's unless it's being pounded by a wind. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's pounded by a wind, there's nobody really fishing it because it's blowing them in and blowing
yep,
them out.
Nobody's there. Yep.
And that's when I want to fish it. Because I'll put in shallow running crankbaits, and then I'll troll it. Mm-hmm. And maybe 30-40% of the time I do it, I'll catch a fish. But there's no one fishing. It's being pounded by the wind. And what will take you an hour and a half, 2 hours to fish, I can do in 15 or 20 minutes, make one pass. I'm not going to get any follows. But if there's a hot fish there, I got a good chance of catching them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So a lot of times I will do that. I will make trolling passes. The other thing is you got a big cabbage bed on a flat, and mm-hmm. the cabbage bed ends in 12, 13, 14, 15 feet. And a lot of times you'll have fringed sand grass that'll be 1 or 2 or 3 foot high. That might go for 20, 30, 40, 50 yards further mm-hmm. out to the drop off. Well, guys aren't going to cast that thing. So I might put a crankbait that comes right over the top, or a deep or weighted deep diving jerkbait and zigzag all over that flat and just jerk, let it go back, jerk, let it go back, and zigzag all over the flat. And a lot of times you catch fish there that no one would even touch. That kind of thing. So it's a lot of it's just thinking, don't think like everybody else because your results are going to be like everybody else.
Right.
So
they're beating their brains in for 3 days for a follow. Yeah. And it's something I look at quite often, with forward facing sonar, some of these patterns you guys had talked about for years, right? Where we're going on that outside edge in the sand grass where nobody's casting, the amount of muskies that are there. Most guys just come raging into the weeds and you go, well, you drop, like with me, I drop my trolling motor down and you're coming in slow. You go, whether you look, whether you're looking for them or not, you know, or you see the follow, it, you know, it, for pattern confirmation, what you guys, you know, yourself, Booker, all the legends there, it's, you guys knew it before everybody else. And now, like, if it's not enough for you with live imaging to confirm this, you know what I'm saying? Like, or to find those, for me, I'm always using it primarily my fall for figure eights, which pointed down the side of the boat, but to find those areas of, like you said, the sand grass or the very outside, very, 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 very outside scruffy weeds, you know, where that's a heck of a tool. You don't have to spend the whole week on the lake to find that, but you know, you can do so many things there. And, you know, you're talking about Eagle, that transition where, whether, you know, you might zip them from the Western arm down to Boulder, you know what I'm saying? That change, would you recommend the same change for somebody like lake hopping? You know, that's always the soup du jour in the Northwoods. You know, you can make the same change there, wouldn't you say? Just trailer your boat.
We've done it many times. You know, when the day starts out, look at the weather. What lake are you gonna go? You know, I'm gonna go to the shallow dark water lake, or the it's gonna be a cloudy day, it's overcast. We'll go to the clear lake over here, the deep clear one. So if you're in a cabin or on a whatever, in a motel, sleeping in your car, I don't care.
Sleeping in a ditch.
Whatever you get. Spend $200 for rods and $40 for lures, then I sleep in a car. So, but yeah, I do the same thing.
Yeah,
same thing on those lakes. You know, if you just got a lot of medium to smaller lakes up, I'll play that game in the morning. Absolutely. Yep.
Very cool. Well, let me ask you this, because you've been there for pretty much all of them. What lures over? Obviously, you know, there's some standouts, but you've seen basically every modern musky lure come out and go away, and some have staying power, some don't. What are some of those classics that you still rely on? Are you still hucking reef hogs? You still hucking suix? What's some stuff that's kind of old school that definitely needs to be in people's tackle boxes, you think?
Well, I probably caught more fish on a 700 Booker deal than anything.
Yeah.
I don't use them much anymore. I'll use like a double eights a lot now. Or that's the Bookers. The double eights I like a lot. The one lure I've used, I've got some nice muskies on in recent years too, is that the stagger blade. I forgot what the guy's name.
Frenzy, musky frenzy. I'm betting.
Yeah, it could be it. Yeah, he's a good guy. Did 8-9. And my favorite color really is black with copper blades. I mean, that works to me. And people weren't even making it, you know. Joe was making it. He made me up some years ago, and I got chewed up and lost and whatever. So every now and then I'll try to find one somewhere. So, you know, musky fishing, a flashing blade is always good. The other thing too, a bit overlooked musky lure too, if blades are good, which they are, we catch more muskies on blades than anything, but people aren't using blades deeper than a few feet, usually 3, 4, 5 feet. But see, I've caught a lot of big muskies on big spinner baits, where I'll throw them to a spot and I'll let them sink, and I'll rip them up and drop them down and bring them in again, and then rip them up and drop them down. Because I saw many, many years ago, we were up in Canada, me and actually Tony Portencasa was my son. And Tony's son was catching way more pike than all of us. We're throwing the big spoons out. And he'd bring, I'm wondering, what's he doing? But what it ended up, he's bringing it in, and then he'd take a bite of a sandwich, scratch his butt, drop his tip back, and his spoon would go backwards a little bit, and he'd get a hit.
Yeah.
And it started dawning on me, you know, we'd bring a spoon in, and we'd start bringing a spoon in and dropping the tip back, bringing a spoon in, dropping the tip back. And you'd see how that would trigger these pike. So that thing held in my mind for muskies too. So that's when it started my thing with the spinner baits, doing that same thing, because you're getting above them, ripping it, and having it flutter back down in their face, and they'll snap at it. And there's a lot of times, if you can get a lure, I've seen muskies, not spawning fish, but fish cruising right through a crankbait in front of them, and bring it right at them and hold a rod tip just so it came right at the level with their face, and they'll just go and snap at it, just like it's a bug and something irritating them. And even on the figure eight, if I make a bunch of the classic ones, and I'll turn around and get one, it will come right toward them a lot more. And a lot of times I'll just open their mouth and snap at it. So the reflex strike with a blade bait, a big overhead spinner, is another thing I'd like to look, you know, big overhead spinner, Mm-hmm. And fish it on the weed line on out, and you rip it, drop it based on the angle of the drop off. You know, if it's deeper, then you got to let a little more time between drops. If it's shallower, then you know, do it quicker. That thing, of course, the top water is always one of my favorites. I've caught more fish on a top rater froggy than anything.
Yeah.
You know, that thing. That's my go-to. I actually was Joe's. We did a trip, and then I took it, and I think I caught a couple of good fish. And I said, "You're not getting it back."
This is mine, man.
I didn't think I would get it back, you know. So that my Goodwill top water I used a lot too, and of course the crankbaits. Yeah. I like the Grandmas. I like the Jakes. I like the top the depth raters.
Mm-hmm.
A good shallow one that I like. I've caught a lot of fish on is a shallow Invader.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. And I've caught a lot, probably more fish trolling that thing than anything. Because I troll it. I try to get them where you troll, and some of them, you get them where they go fast enough, and they'll kick out. They'll kick out to mm-hmm. left to right, like that. And I like that a lot with the trolling, where if you can get stuff that'll kick out, or every now and then you got to rip it like that, you're going to catch way more fish than a straight troll. Mm-hmm. Way more. You know, when I'm fishing Minnesota or Canada, and I'm fishing a place you're only allowed one rod, there's no way in hell I'm going to put that thing in a rod holder.
No.
Because if I go over a point or every now and then, I'm going to give it a rip to drop it back. And there's been a lot of times I just feel like somebody hit my finger or somebody hit my line with a pencil. Mm-hmm. And rip it forward, drop it back, boom, and you got a good muskie on there. Well, so,
I'm realizing how many things I thought I stole from Joe that he stole from you. That I've just gotten third hand. You're saying this, like, you know, here I'm. the you had me with the spinnerbait thing. We've actually, it's funny. I designed a spinnerbait just for that a while ago. It's amazing. You know, you've been doing this crap at that level for this long.
It's my picture of my muskie in the Hall of Fame from 1989 was caught on a big spinnerbait.
Yep.
And that was 89. I probably caught it in 87. So.
Goodness gracious. I was six, you know.
Were you born then?
I was six, yeah. I was a couple years shy of my first muskie, I think, at that point, yeah. That is phenomenal. Just an absolute, you're a wealth of knowledge, obviously, here. So, well, guys, we're going to wrap it up here, Spence. I appreciate you coming on. We'll do it again here real soon. I know you'll... placate us and shed some more light on this stuff for us. So thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Anytime.
What do you think of that, Jay?
Awesome.
That's as good.
Repeated listening is probably suggested.
Probably. There are some morsels in there. I'm trying to coax it out. I apologize. It's the middle of the day, so my dog's out there. You might hear, I'm running back here. Things out there chewing on rocks or whatever he does.
Whatever Bruce does when he's by himself.
Free Steve Stash giveaway. Come get my dumb dog. He's your problem now. Anyway, we might as hit a cut. Let's hit a couple Q&As while we're here. Why not, Jay? Q's and A's? What are you thinking?
Surely.
Michael, row the boat ashore. I love to night fish. Everyone else is putting their boat on the trailer. When I'm dipping mine in, two-part question. When casting, do you figure it after every cast, even while night fishing? Absolutely. I can answer that one. Even more so when night fishing, right? If you don't see them coming, absolutely. No questions asked. It is a prerequisite on every front. Number two, lightning. I try to use only my stern light so I don't spook anything, but it's hard to judge distance on a new moon night. Do you think any kind of boat light scares these fish? So, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Something, you know, we've said we'll cover older things and bring them back. So if you've not heard this, here it goes. Figure this little morsel out. This is my dumb hack to night fishing. Speaking of Spence and old school and dumb stuff, you go to the store and you buy you can be fancy like I used to do it, guiding a lot of night trips when I wasn't afraid of getting hooked by people, but your little buoys, right? So you have your little float buoys, those, electrical tape, and a glow stick are your friend. If you want to get really redneck with it, cut the labels off of like a Coke bottle, right? I got tons of empty clear plastic bottles. stick some glow sticks from the Dollar General in that bad boy, put the cap on, put an egg sinker on the bottom and some string. I mark the edges I'm fishing. I do that before sunset, put them out there. Nobody else is out there. All the other boats are coming in. Go, I'm going to hit these three or four key areas. I take my Coke bottles with glow sticks and some twine and a sinker on them and go, okay, this is the right-hand aspect of the weed bed, or this is the left-hand aspect, or whatever. And I will actually mark them port and starboard. So let's say I have an outside weed edge I want to fish, right? I will stick green glow sticks in one Coke bottle or tape them to my buoy if you're not a redneck, and lower that on that very outside edge. If it's a really big edge, I might drop another color, say like having a yellow or a blue or something that's going to stand out from the red and green, drop that in the middle, and then the extreme end of that, put out reds. So I know the green is going to be my starting point, and I can kind of target and hold my edge with electronics, having the midpoint marker and then the endpoint marker. So now I've defined the edge that I'm targeting. Now I have a visual representation of where I need to be casting, and it really opens things up. So I'm not looking at the dreaded screen all the time. No matter how low you set your electronics, you look down at them, then you look out on a new moon night, or there's not a lot of light, and your eyes are adjusting. You're like, whoa, this is awful, right? Turn it off, right? Now, with that being said, when running at night, always have your navigation lights on as per state guidelines. Jay, correct?
Yeah.
You should never go dark. Have it once again, Jay. Say it. You say it, Shill. Say the line. You should always have your navigational lights on as per state and Coast Guard regulations. Agreed, Jay?
100%.
100%. So, you should, you know, but how, whatever you got to do, be safe. But I like to have things as dark as I can in the boat, so I don't have this light that I'm competing with. I don't want any light hitting the water, because what's more unnatural at night for a muskie than a light? It's not natural.
How do you feel about using like LED red light?
I was about to go there, which is...
Okay.
Hold on. Let's get him. Hey. What are you doing? Hold on. Herbie's trying to call me. Bear with me. Herbeck. Hey,
so
you're on the podcast.
You got Spence rolling already.
You're on the podcast. What?
I see you got Spence rolling already.
I did. Hey, man, you're on the podcast right now. Let's talk night fishing. You got Jay there.
Okay, hang on a second. I gotta be able to hear you a little better. I'm on the road. Hang on.
Oh boy,
Jay.
We're getting locked in now, baby.
I'm saying, how many times did I say you're on the podcast just for safety? You noticed that, right, Jay? Like, do not.
Yeah.
All right. Away.
I you called me. I got to answer the call. We're sitting here recording this thing. I'm talking about going dark at night for nighttime muskies, answering a question here, right? So kind of gave him the layout. What's Herbie's nighttime musky tips? What are you doing?
Well, I mean, muskies are some of the heaviest night feeders of freshwater fishing, other than maybe catfish or something. I mean, their lateral lines are extremely, high in the hierarchy of fish. You know what I mean? They can see real well. They got great lateral lines. And unfortunately, most good water these days, it's being fished hard these days. Let's just face it. There's the days of virgin water are pretty few and far between. You know what I'm saying? And the more lake gets fished hard, the more lake has recreational activities on it, and but not necessarily prerequisite. Generally, the clearer the water, even the more so. Night fishing is about the only way to go sometimes. What I found on real dark water is it works real well up until about an hour after dark, and it starts tapering off. And on real clear water, the witching hour, and it can last all night, So anytime that you're having a tougher time, you're seeing fish, they aren't biting, you got a lot of activity on your lake and everything, just, you know, take a nap, get some suntans, have a couple beers, and then head out about an hour and a half before dark, and then start on the sides of the lake that has the sunset behind it. That'll give you an extra hour of the witching hour, okay? You know, of course, there has to be good structures, but if you can find high banks, tall pine trees on the sides of the lake that the wind is, the sun is setting behind, it'll give you an extra hour, hour and a half of that magic witching hour right before dark.
Very nice.
You know, and that's the key. And then in reverse, you know, if you either you fish it all night or you get up and you go for the ass crack of dawn, well, you make sure you get on the other side of the lake where the sun is rising behind the tall pines and the shorelines. And I particularly love narrows early in the morning with tall banks, tall wall banks, and then pine trees on top of them. I can have a shade line until 10:30 in some places. And on hot, flat, sunny conditions, particularly in clear water, that type of stuff can extend your bite, can really put, you know, advantage in your favor. Then, you know, as far as presentations, it really don't matter. I mean, you can fish what you fish during the day. But historically, you know, people love fishing topwaters after dark. You know, that's always a lot of fun. I mean, I think conservatively, if I really want to catch fish bad rather than just get a hard on, because I had a topwater strike, I will probably go with a jointed crankbait like the pounder. I'll probably go, you know, with a double 10 or a 9-10 blade bait or a big spinner bait with a number 9 Colorado on the end of it. Always has been a deadly bait for me after dark, and especially if it's windy. You know, you got any type of a frontal situation where you know it's been a cold front coming in or something. Those type of presentations will generally catch a fish when others won't. You got good stable weather. You got a little bit calmer to a light chop type of water. Well, you know how much I love topwater fishing. You know, that'll just light your life up. You know what I'm saying? But don't be stuck on it. You know what I mean? Don't be stuck on it. Any of your baits that you work during the day will work during that night. But look for something that has a little bit more vibration, that you can work a little bit slower. You know, I don't do a lot of herky-jerky type of stuff after that, even when I'm running rubber, like, you know, like Bulldogs or you know, the Savage Triple Tail there, stuff like that. I kind of tend to stay more straight, maybe a couple small pulls with a drop during the retrieve. But those fish, they feel those vibrations. You know, we caught fish on Bulldogs back in the 80s, doing nothing but reeling them in, and everybody else was using globes and great big crankbaits and stuff like that. And we caught fish right behind people with Bulldogs and Big Joes and stuff, doing nothing but reeling them slow and steady. So those fish know they're there. And it is the more natural presentation. It feels and vibrates and moves water like a real fish. So that has something to do, you know, with fish that are conditioned and see a lot of bait, you know, things like that.
Sir, does that complete your order?
What?
Does that complete your order, sir? Would you like to add an apple pie?
Well, I got more shit if you
want to
talk about it.
Well, I was really hoping you would have an opinion on it, but sir, this is an Arby's. That's phenomenal. Man, heck.
Well, anyway, you guys can carry on. I'll call you. I just had the guy give me the finger because I almost ran him off the road. So.
Well, give it back. I'll call you when I get done, buddy. Be good.
All right.
Hang up for me so I don't lose Jay. Thank you.
Okay. There we go. That was awesome. That was awesome.
It was cool because I mowed my lawn. during that time frame.
I picked up a bunch of branches in the yard while he was talking too. Yeah,
you know, it's amazing. Love him. Paul the Plumber. Yeah. Love the podcast. Meow. I've been listening for quite a while and can't for the life of me remember ever hearing about, can't remember when I heard you guys talk about joint baits, when and what conditions use them. Thanks, Jay, for helping me pick out my new trolling rod and reel in March. You boys rock. He says he can't remember if we ever talked about it. We did, and we've done it. But yeah, we're going to do it again. Jointed versus straight. Right? Here's the deal. Everybody loves jointed baits. Like, oh, jointed baits, it's special because it's jointed. No. Simple. Jointed baits present fish with the illusion of speed.
Yep.
That's it. Don't go, okay, I'm going to. You can actually fish, or you should be fishing straight crank baits faster, ripping, jerking, bang, 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 banging around, doing all this fun stuff with your straight crankbaits. Your jointed crankbait is a deadly weapon for bad conditions where you can just slow it down, right? That's why I love, Herbie just talked about, I love the pounder because, you know, bad conditions, I'm going to put on the jointed crankbait that runs deep and holds deep. It doesn't float up real fast because I want to get down. I want to get in their face. And you're getting more illusion of motion over a shorter distance, right? So the joint actually creates more resistance in the water. So they typically run shallower. That's why, like Herbie, when he worked on the pounder, made it heavier so it gets deep. So in bad conditions, we need a deep running crankbait that gives the illusion of motion at slower speed. So that jointed bait kicking side to side is doing more over a shorter distance at a slower speed. That's when to fish the jointed baits. Ripping, you know, rip it, let it hang with like your something as simple as like a what's the Tom LeBeau, their sand cat, or at Big Fork, they've got those jointed baits, Jay, that remind me of like a chub, like the chub minnow, pikey minnow.
Reef jiggers, twitch darters.
And you've got, you know, you got your jointed shallow raiders. And, you know, even to some extent, I look at, Spence mentioned it earlier, the shallow invader, right? It's got a soft tail, but it kind of is doing the jointed thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Sure. It's a heck of a lot more action opposed to just ripping your straight bait. So that's the rule of thumb. If you need to slow things down and you need to cover water, it's a little more, to me, a jointed crankbait being used for a more finessey thing. Most guys just grab a jointed crankbait because it's jointed, it's got more action, and you're doing yourself a disservice. So, you know, your straight depth raider or your jointed pounder, look at them as two different presentations at two different times. That's kind of the rule of thumb there. Rich, what are your thoughts on leaders for minnow baits? Swivel, no swivel on the leader when fishing these style baits. Jay, you just did a little thing on the right leader for the right job or something. What do you think? Minnow baits, swivel, no swivel?
Yeah, minnow baits, if he's talking like a 6-inch minnow bait, like a 6-inch grandma, 6-inch slammer, small crane bait, something light that is designed to be twitched, stop and go, shallow running. Those baits run usually, let's say those baits are 1 to 1.5 ounces. 60 pound to 80 pound. I don't like using 60 for musky, but I guess I'd go 80 pound fluorocarbon. Most 80 pound fluorocarbon leaders have lighter terminal tackle too. You know, they have smaller bearings.
Hold on. Swivel or no swivel?
Yeah. Oh, I always use a swivel.
Okay, yeah. That answers that. Sorry, he was asking which swivel. If you want,
if you have a choice, go with something small, like a number 3.
Well,
as opposed to a big, heavy one.
Understood. And I don't see a problem with a swivel on a leader when fishing your minnow baits. It helps correct things. You know, it straightens things out. So anyway, we'll do one more here. Goodness gracious. Let me pick. Hold on. Kevin, I'm a weekend guy and having problems getting dialed in this spring. Weather's very up and down where I'm at, fishing all kinds of different areas. It's Kevin, answer your question. It is discombobulated out there. You've got to pattern per day, right? You've got to take everything into account. You're not going to, and that's what's tough. And, you know, there's everybody starts as a weekend angler. That's most everybody. And that's absolutely fine. It's tough. It really is. You don't have the advantage of, hey, I've been out here for 6 days. If you don't know what's going on, then you're in too deep, right? But hey, you wake up, you got Saturday morning or you got Sunday or whatever it might look like. Do your homework before you get out there. Be watching weather patterns before you ever leave the house. If you know you're going to fish Saturday, be thinking ahead, conceptualizing what's happening. How is the weather going to impact? Where am I at in a musky pattern, right? Is it prefrontal? Is it postfrontal? You can make a lot of decisions before you ever hit the water on where your game plan is going to start, right? Now, in the spring, generally, you know, the way things are happening right now, you got to do a little bit of everything. You know, maybe even the north section or these other areas that are about to open up, it might be a little bit more forgiving. But right now, we're dealing with fish on the bottom at 20 and fish in inches spawning, right? So you got to look at forage, right? The hungry muskies are going to be where the forage is at. And so that's my first and foremost thing. It would be where the food's at. Be near the refrigerator and plan ahead. Look at, like I said, look at what's happening climatically. Look at what's happening in every little piece of information that you can use to conceptualize what the most logical outcome is when you hit the water. That's how you get your starting point. That's going to speed up patterning. It's going to speed it up immensely. Fact. Jay, I can't believe it. Herbie calls. He knew Spence called. The legend's legend. What do you think of that?
Herbie hears everything. He knows before. Yeah, I mean, it's just instantaneous.
Why did I have to talk to him? Why did you make me talk to that guy? I just want to go to bed.
He should have known better than to call you.
Oh, goodness. Anyway, I'll yak anybody's ear off, Jay. All right, Jay Bird, say good afternoon.
Thanks, guys.
Later.
Surface bait.